Hello and welcome to the Town Hall Theatre in Galway. What a fine bundle of people these Galwegians and non-Galwegians are. We are here in Galway for the Galway International Arts Festival 2025. Arena will broadcast from the festival tonight and tomorrow. Both shows packed with performers and organisers from the festival, as well as reviews and previews of many of the major events happening between now and Sunday week, July the 27th, which of course is the final day of the festival. Tonight we'll hear from Ian Lloyd Anderson, Sarah Morris and Andrew Flynn of Decadent Theatre, Owen the Vardoon and Rosie McCarthy Adair of Moonfish Theatre, Festival Director Paul Fahey will be with us, and Jane Cassidy and Natasha Lydon of Arts Alive. But to get our first arena at the Galway International Arts Festival underway, please welcome Oisín Leach with a song called One Hill Further.
Sadness runs like a fever. It runs with the season. You call it justice, and it leaves us one hill further. A story about the clemency a brother lost his brother, a tragedy. Help me sing the loneliness of the sea. Running northwards, a refugee. You call it hiding, I call it sympathy. I have done no wrong, implore the lonesome sea. Look out further to a northern town. See the sun rise over sacred ground. And don't forget us if you leave us one hill further. Now I see us through the red dust, one hill further, one hill further.
Absolutely beautiful. One Hill Further, the title of that track from Oisín Leach. That's from his album Cold Sea, and along with Oisín there you heard Graeme Heaney on double bass, Cormac Curran on keys, Oisín on guitar, on vocals and harmonica in the middle of all of that as well. We'll have more music from the lads during the show, and we'll have a bit of a chat with Oisín later on as well. Decadent Theatre Company bring us two hard-hitting monologues from the playwright Simon Stevens to this year's Galway International Arts Festival. In T5, Sarah Morris is a woman in her mid-30s who is dealing with a shocking personal crisis and has to decide to turn one way or another to change her life. And in Seawall, Ian Lloyd Anderson is a man who painstakingly recounts the story of a family day out on the beach with his father-in-law. These two pieces are currently running at the Nuns Island Theatre Space in Galway, and with me in the Town Hall Theatre this evening, actors Ian Lloyd Anderson and Sarah Morris, as well as director of Decadent, Andrew Flynn. You know, I was thinking, I was listening to that song from Oisín, I don't know how long it was, about 3 minutes, and there's an entire story packed into that 3 minutes. Not dissimilar, Sarah, to what we get from your shows. It's not just a story packed into about 25 minutes, half an hour in the case of this monologue. It's a whole life in some ways packed into that 25 minutes.
100%.
Who is she, this woman that you're playing?
I think she's kind of everyone in some ways. There's a kind of an anonymity to her, which is interesting.
We never get her name, sure.
We never get her name. Mm. She's called Woman. But I mean, in terms of, she plays all these roles in terms of, she's a mother, she's a wife, she's a daughter, a sister. But she's kind of lost within that. And I think you kind of get all these threads of her life and the different relationships that she has, but in a very vague way. Mm. And we attach so much to that as women. I remember reading it. I thought, I know who she is to other people, but who is she to herself?
Good question to ask about anybody, really.
Well, this is it, yeah.
Yourself, never mind your characters.
Yeah. So, I think she's kind of struggling with that along the way because she witnesses an event that has a profound effect on her, and it kind of punctures who she is, and she starts to ask a lot of questions, which is really fun to play, actually.
I wouldn't have said fun, but yeah, I can understand, yeah, because it is these questions. She's not necessarily getting the answers, but she has loads of questions. And in the case of your fellow, we do find out his name is Alex. Am I right in thinking that, Ian?
Yeah,
Anderson?
Alex, yeah.
Yeah, and we do get the names of his wife, of his daughter, of his father-in-law, and he's on the beach recounting this story. I have to say, it packs such, and we have to be really careful in both monologues, really, about how much we tell about what is told in this story.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that it strikes me, Simon Stevens, the playwright, was reading something he said about this particular piece. He said it was him at his most unguarded. I think he was actually on a holiday, as this character is recounting a holiday on a beach in the south of France. Yeah. The playwright was on a holiday when he wrote this. He put himself into scary places.
He put himself into a pretty scary place, all right, yeah. But, yeah, I think it's the kind of perfect description of it, is unguarded and it's raw. And I suppose our aim when we went into it was to kind of present it in a way that is, I suppose in some ways, kind of untheatrical, you know. It's lit in an untheatrical way. I mean, obviously your performance, while trying to be, you have to be theatrical to be untheatrical in some ways.
Yeah.
It's just a man who tells a story, and I suppose he's unguarded in the sense that I don't think, you know, in the playing of it, I suppose he, at the beginning of the play, he doesn't realise that he's going to tell this story of grief, I suppose, and the effects of grief, and then trying to sort of struggle his way through with his own battle of kind of what fate is.
Mm.
And he's really kind of stuck between his own belief and his own disbelief, and how someone else's belief is able to pull them through something. And I think that's a big part of it.
Yeah, the father-in-law is very much a believer. There's a great kind of mathematical thing that runs through the script, in fact, where
the mentions of pi and all that.
Yeah,
kind of
the father-in-law says, well, pi exists, and if that irrational number can exist, there has to be a God. And there's another point, I don't know whether this is the father-in-law's words or whether these are Alex's words, where he talks about the space between two numbers.
Yes, that's again the father-in-law. And I think that links back to there's something where
he became a maths teacher. The space between two numbers.
Yeah, well, he says it once he left the army, the father-in-law, he became a maths teacher. That's the first time we've thought about that, Andrew.
We've not really done our homework on this play at all,
to be honest.
Back
to rehearsals. Yeah.
I think we're going to be called in early now, tomorrow.
Can Oisín play another song now?
We'll get you in next year now, Sean.
But it did strike me, because there's, and even though it is mathematics and all the rest of it, I have a bit of an interest in maths. Maybe the nerd in me is coming out there. But there's something terribly ordinary about these people, as in Sarah's character. Like, they're just ordinary folk telling us a chunk of their life, and in fact telling us their whole lives, but emotionally very taut situations. I mean, how wrecked are you? I saw the performance yesterday. How wrecked are you emotionally after telling that story? Don't tell us any more about what the story tells us.
Oh, I'm grand. I'm grand. That's the gig in some ways. I mean, that's... No, I'm fine. It's not lovely to do, but it is. That, I think, like as an actor, that's what you want to be doing.
Yeah.
You
don't, like, putting yourself into those difficult situations.
Yeah, to an extent. Yeah, and you know, and you're grand. Like an hour after, if you're having a pint in Galway, you're all right. you're okay. So, yeah. But it is. I mean, you do have to go somewhere, but that can be quite. That can be quite liberating in itself, I suppose. Yeah. In some ways, it's a bit like this. A good cry will always sort you out.
I suppose your character has to do the same thing, sir. You are in again. I don't want to give too much away in terms of where she is or what she's at, but it's a very tense and difficult situation where she has to make a tough choice about something she is thinking about.
Very tough. I think the interesting thing with my character is that she's hyper aware at a certain point. So. Every sound, every sensation, every feeling. And she's kind of observing things in a very detailed way that quite often when we go about normal life, we don't take the time to observe.
Yeah.
And in a way, she's quite highly strung. So you find yourself after you come off, you just take a breath. You just really...
To loosen up the
strings.
Because
you're holding a lot of tension. But... Yeah, it's kind of, it is liberating as well, isn't it?
Coming to you then, Andrew Flynn, who is the director of Decadent Theatre and director of this. The monologue in the, there was a period in the 90s when there wasn't a single play out there. Everything was a monologue. Were you worried about taking two monologues and putting them together as an evening? How do these two pieces turn into an entire evening rather than two separate performances?
Sure. Well, no is the answer because I love the monologue myself. And I think...
Fond of it myself too, I have to say.
and I know, knowing the space, that was a kind of a starting point when I talked to Paul. It's like we were looking for monologues. And of course, we have brilliant monologue writers, Friel and McPherson and Eugene O'Brien. But what interested me was Simon Stevens, while he's massively internationally known, he's not hugely done in Ireland.
He's from Belfast originally.
He's from Belfast originally and like has a huge career, I suppose, in England and an awful lot of his work has gone to Broadway. And this particular play I had read and loved it.
Which one, T5 or?
Seawall.
Seawall, that's
where it started with Seawall. And madly, I kind of went... But sure, it's only 35 minutes long. Like, how do we do a play that's only 35 minutes long? And now we're going, imagine if you were doing it, you know, it feels like a full evening in the theatre.
But we're milking it and
made it 42.
Yeah, shorten those pauses. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You don't need to leave an infinity of space between two words.
No, we're trying to justify the price of the ticket and stuff. But that was the starting point. And then when I talked to Simon, what was very interesting, the only advice he gave me was try and do it without anything. This was Seawall. Yeah. So he said, if you can, avoid sound effects. If you can, avoid lighting changes. Which is scary because Fareen, he's completely exposed when he was up.
Well, in both cases, if the words don't carry it, forget it. But you can have flashing lights up and down. You can have loads of sound effects. If the words don't carry it, good night. It's not going to work anyway.
But what was interesting was when T5 arrived.
Yeah.
And he didn't give me any indication.
So that was a new piece that he presented to you, is it?
Yeah, well, it has been done. I think it was originally written to be part of a collection of monologues called Pornography, and it didn't make it in. So this piece came, and what was really interesting was I didn't tell Sarah about it. I didn't really tell Ian about it. I didn't tell our sound designer, Carl. And everyone's instinct, I knew, but everyone's instinct was the same as Simon's. That T5 actually, because it's more like a stream of consciousness, could take...
A few changes, exactly. Atmosphere. And they're very subtle, it has to be said, those changes.
But Seawall, everyone's instinct was leave it alone. Just
say it.
And what's happened is the audience come in and they see this play and I think a language has started and then you come in and there's nothing.
Yeah.
And there's something, I think, in that lends to it.
The other thing that I think, I saw that you had spent time... Obviously, you didn't rehearse together because they're two separate pieces in that respect. But you did, towards the end of the rehearsal period, Sarah, you went in to sit in an Ian's rehearsal and the other way around. How much did that inform what you did in T5?
It actually really helped because, look, nothing's scarier than performing for your colleagues and your peers, because you respect and admire their work.
Mm.
But I think for me, and I wouldn't be particularly, you know, mad for the monologue play. I like people sitting around drinking
cups
of tea and talking to each other. But I mean, when I was watching Ina, I really feel like when a performer can be brave enough to be bare and to just let the story speak, you're so with them. And things you learn just about God, like you could take longer there, or you know, I'm clued in, because quite often you have this thing as a performer where you go, I'm still talking.
Yeah.
You're gonna be sick of me talking now. I really enjoyed watching, and also the kind of antithesis of what our two pieces say. And we have a beautiful, Ian said to me, which I didn't even realise, we actually share the same line in both plays, and we say...
And then when you hear that line spoken by that character, it's a whole different ballgame, I'm sure.
Yeah. What is it? And this is a bit like that.
And for you, Ian, was that when you saw Sarah's, how much did it inform, how did it inform you in the performance of Seawall?
Well, I mean, Sarah's an incredible actor. And no, I'm not just saying that because you're here. I'd say it anyway. So the first thing you do is you go, right, you better up your game. But it informs you in the sense that you go, that you realise you have to be fully committed to go, to because you're on second. And you do have to, you've got to be at a level.
Ready.
It's kind of a lovely thing. And we have a good relationship, me and Sarah, where we can kind of,
observation.
And thank you really helped me there.
There's a hint for directors, they're observations.
Always well aware of that. I think in being able to being able to do that and sort of pass it back to each other is very helpful. Also, just it would be such a lonely job.
Yeah, be there by yourself.
I know. Really would.
I remember David Kelly, the great David Kelly, telling a story about going on to do Crap's last tape by himself. And he sat down in front of the tape recorder and he heard from the front row, oh, I hate him.
Oh, Jesus.
So I hope neither of you will hear that over the next one.
But what is interesting, though, is, and it's a truth, I remember when I started out and I was very young and enthusiastic, Patrick Mason.
Younger. More enthusiastic.
I went to a talk with Patrick Mason and I got chatting to him after, and he said to me, and I'll never forget it, he said, for theatre to exist, you need an audience, an actor and a space. And he says, that's the essence of theatre. And these plays are like that. And only, I mean, Ian and Sarah, I had such a pleasure. All I had to do was let them off and watch them.
Another good note for a director.
Completely.
Let them off.
And let them off. But it was an honour to sit and watch them. And I had very, very little to do.
Well, listen, thanks to all three.
I don't agree with that.
I'm sure all of you, none of you did anything. It doesn't look like that. Making it look like you did nothing, which is really great, is what you all do, which is the real skill. Andrew Flynn, Sarah Morris and Ian Lloyd Anderson there. T5 and Seawall continue at Nuns Island Theatre nightly through until Saturday the 26th. No shows on the Sunday, but there are 2 p.m. matinees on both Thursdays and Saturdays. As with everything we'll be speaking about this evening, GIAF.ie is the website to check everything out. Back with more from the Town Hall Theatre after this break. And welcome back to the Town Hall Theatre in Galway for this arena special from the Galway International Arts Festival. With me now, Paul Fahey, Artistic Director of the festival. Just wondering, Paul, you've been putting together the programme for the Galway International Arts Festival for a wee while now. I presume you don't start in September or October of last year going, I'm going to get loads of stuff about X and everything's going to fit that theme. I guess a theme and ideas and what's happening, that begins to emerge as you're putting the programme together.
It does. And you're rolling ahead a lot longer than
12 months. Even 12 months.
But we do turn around things. Like I like the notion that festivals have kind of a flexibility and you can respond to something, whether that's a hot topic socially or you see something at relatively short notice and it's brilliant and you want to, and it's available. Yeah. So you try and make room for all of that.
And what kind of topics started to present themselves as you were putting this
so
programme together?
What I tend not to do is to say that this year we're going to have this kind of a theme and then try to, it works for some festivals, but that's not the way I like to approach work. So what we do is, you know, when we're, say, commissioning work or we're, producing or co-producing theatre productions or whatever, and you're anchoring the different art forms, And then they kind of start to speak to each other in a way, and you start looking for threads that, you know, of stuff that would work in conjunction with other things that you've already booked. Yeah. Like, so for example, like, we know what our key theatre production that we're producing next year is going to be. So I'm thinking about that and thinking about what else would look good around that and whatever. But again, we don't necessarily put that. I never kind of try to force that on people. You know, audiences are smart. They'll find that those threads themselves. So it's a combination of your forward planning all the time. You know, we're going to be 50 in 2027. So Druid are 50 this year. So big birthdays happening all around us. So we're planning for that as well.
And we have to be clear, you haven't been directing the festival for all 50 of them.
I was very, very small when that happened. But you're a combination of things, you know, stuff that's foreplanned for a long time, and then, as I said, allowing that flexibility to respond.
I don't think I'm forcing any of the items into a box when I say that the whole idea of climate change, of what we as humans are doing to this planet and have been doing to this planet for quite a long time.
I mean, that's something we've been interested in doing, both from a public facing point of view in terms of the program for a good number of years. I suppose probably most famously, I suppose with John Gerard, you know, ecology is very much at the core of all the work that he does. But we also have a big sustainability policy. You know, we have our own workshop in Galway where we repurpose pretty much everything that we build ourselves. It reappears the following year as something else. We've taken 100,000 plastic glasses out of the Heineken Big Top over the last couple of years. So we're trying to be as climate friendly as you can yourself. But then in terms of program,
David Mack is back, and that kind of speaks directly to that.
Absolutely.
It?
And David has for a long, long time worked with mass produced materials and reconfigure those as pieces of art. So whether or not it's, you know, loads of newspapers or tires or in this case coat hangers in a section of his show, and that's a big commentary in terms of how we consume. But then I also love approach and work with, for example, we're in the town hall when Dimanche is on from Focus and Châtelet from Belgium, and that's a really, really brilliant show in terms of its messaging. So it's about these three reporters who are going to the North Pole documenting the melting ice caps, but it's told in such a beautiful way, and it's told visually. So it's getting across a very important message. It's not being didactic, it's not hitting us over the head, and that's a much better way to generate conversation.
Because I would have thought that is one thing that you would be avoiding, is any kind of preaching at people.
No,
here's what you should be thinking and should be doing.
And you know, that's I think a characteristic of the festival that we're very proud that we never do that, and we never create any kind of obstacles with people. We open doors, we're very welcoming to everybody. So you know, if you want to come in and interrogate something in the highest intellectual way possible, you're very, very welcome. If you want to come in and walk around and have a look at something, you're also welcome, and everybody in between is.
Yeah,
but you know,
most good pieces of art ask questions and come up with your own answers.
Stay with it. You know, so for example, that show Dimanche, like I saw a development of that 4 or 5 years ago. It was a small little 20-minute piece, and those images stayed in my head and it carry a very powerful message.
Tell me a little bit about Iman Mohammed and a photojournalist, a Palestinian photojournalist, and the work that's coming from.
She is extraordinary. She's from Gaza. She's been documenting what's been going on there all of her life. So she's incredible photographs. So for the show, what we've done is it's in a couple of different kind of chapters. It's all projected image. So we see the genocide, we see the destruction that's happening, not just now, but over a long number of years. And then we also see elements of survival, because you know, people have to survive and they're raising their children. So she captures a great insight into that, into how people cope. But it is, there's no question about it. The imagery is very harrowing, as you can imagine. And also Iman is speaking as part of our First Thought Talks program next weekend, or this coming weekend as well, rather. So she's an incredible voice.
One other thing I wanted to just highlight is Funeral for Ashes from Conor Maloney and John Kennedy. I love the sound of this, but I'm sad about the sound of it as well.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's, you know, in terms of kind of heightening awareness of what's going on. So that's about, it's, first of all, I should say, it's a beautiful piece of immersive insulation, all video projection. You walk
dealing with the death of the ash.
Dealing with the death of the ash, one of our native trees. There's a ash dieback, and it's anticipated or expected that about 90% of the ash tree population will be wiped out from this. So they've and this it's a a project we're doing with Paysetters, which is an EU project, and it's all about sustainability and climate awareness and all that kind of thing. Would you walk into an enclosed room, and the images are projected on all the walls and on the floor, but it's also interactive, so you can actually, there's the body motion camera tracking cameras.
Can you touch?
So you could, it tracks your movement. So as you move, and then you can see how it's affecting the images.
And where is that? Where
was
that?
At the Printworks. Showing alongside Aaron Lawler.
Okay, you're going to stay with us because I'm sure you'll have something to say about the next thing we're going to talk about as well, because also at the table with us here in the Town Hall Theatre are Eoin de Bardoon and Rosie McCarthy Adair of Moonfish Theatre. Their show is called Why the Moon Travels and invites audiences to a place where modern Ireland, I suppose, meets an older era through a retelling of Irish traveller folk tales. Created by an all-traveller ensemble and based on Eoin de Bardoon's best-selling book, this production blends traditional stories about animals, mysterious beings, flawed humans, and lived memories of the performers themselves. I'm delighted that Eoin and Rosie are with me. This is based on a book of yours, which collected these stories. I'm just wondering, Eoin, so they were oral stories that you collected from the traveller tradition. How did you go about doing that, first of all?
Well, I was blessed to be growing up with a lot of people who would be like storytellers and collectors and people who were just filled with loads of knowledge. And I'm also blessed rather than having curiosity, I'm pure nosy. So I have a huge need of going, why does that thing do that? Why does this thing do this? What do we have this knowledge of our origins as subjects? And as a community, we've kept the origin stories of many, many things, from creatures to the movement of celestial bodies, everything in between, that the wider community, due to many reasons, has lost. And as a part of the process of the first creation of the book, I really wanted to maintain the oral histories and the oral techniques. So it was recorded orally first. Then it was transcribed.
Because I was wondering, what happened to the stories, these oral stories, when you wrote them down? But you weren't writing them, really. No. You were transcribing them. It's a different. That's a different thing.
And if you read them, they come out, because they were recorded orally, it comes up in a different cadence. When we write in a very structured way. But when we speak with a different type of rhythm.
Yeah.
And you read it, you can pick up on that kind of the ebb and flow of the human kind of nature within it. I think that not only honours that oral tradition, but also it represents that those stories are a version of the story. We don't have definitive versions. They're not the versions. They're a version.
And Rosie, your involvement in the show, I'll come back to Eoin on the specifics of the stories that are told, but your involvement in the show is particularly as a singer. How important for you is singing in terms of simply telling a story and singing as part of your own traveller tradition?
Well, I mean, like, I suppose I've been singing for as long as I can remember, you know, like all my families and things, they'd all sing songs. And
so was yours a singing family as opposed to necessarily a storytelling family?
But like, I suppose every song, you know, tells a story, like, and that's a big part of it. Like, you know, you can't really fully understand the song until you know the story behind it, you know, because it'd be like very emotional things. Like I find lots of the songs that I sing are kind of sad songs, but I try to come away from that, but I feel like they're just the best stories.
Song. Well, it's better to cry. Than laugh at a song. I don't know.
Yeah, no, but it's really important to know the story, you know, like, because
singing all your life, like, how quickly was it noticed within your family that you were the singer, and a singer that I think has a performing life ahead of her as much as anything else?
I suppose they just couldn't keep me quiet, I suppose. Since I could talk, I suppose I was singing, you know, like, and my brothers, you know, we'd all have CDs in the car and we'd all be fighting over who has ones with the best songs, and, you know, like.
And what were you listening to on those CDs? Was it across all kinds of music from your own tradition, from all other traditions?
Yeah, just kind of like, there's a bit of country and some old kind of Irish songs, you know, a bit of a mix now, to be honest, but just all them kind of songs.
And Eoin, Rosie is there, that there are songs that are parts of these stories or that kind of illustrate the stories in some ways. And Rosie has performed those and they're played out. But then you have three women, Ellen Doyle, Sarah McDonough and Katrina Connors.
Yes.
The three of them telling stories as themselves, are they're not characters per se.
You know, and it was really important to us because within the Trevor tradition, we have almost like three principal rules of storytelling, which we want to actually present as well onto the stage. One is that if you receive a story, you have the onus to pass it on. Second is that kind of you always tell the story is absolutely honest and truthful and real because it carries someone through with it. And you always acknowledge where it comes from. So in the part of acknowledge where it comes from, when people were sharing the stories, they had to actually show where the anchor of that story was. Rather than I just plucked a story from the ether, here's the story and this is what it resonates in me. And this is what it feels to me and this is what it reminds me of. So it's not just a projection of passivity out into an audience. It's we want to have a conversation with you.
And funny enough, Rosie, I was watching a thing you did on YouTube And at the very beginning of it, that's precisely what you do. You talk about who gave you the song. You acknowledge the origins of the song, and you're very clear that you want to tell the truth of the story. So the same rules in that Owen has mentioned there apply to singing.
No, definitely. Like, you know, because like, even like some of the songs you sing, like say I'm from Cork, like, so I could sing a song.
I never would have guessed that.
Definitely not. I'm in dangerous ground here in Galway. But no, like, you know, like different families could have different versions of songs, you know, because like people didn't write down the songs. It was all like, you know, you'd learn the song from hearing someone singing it, like, so the words, some of the words could be different, or like the air of the song might be a small bit different in different places you go around, like, so. Like, I sang a song, Smuggling the Tin, and I was in a documentary a few years ago called Songlines, and Thomas McCarthy was doing it with me, like, and I sang Smuggling the Tin, but then someone else from up the country sang a different version of it, you know, so it was nice to hear the two different versions.
Yeah, so, and those, it's not that this is the right version, these are different versions. Smuggling the Tin, I'm going to get Rosie to sing a little bit of it. You might explain to us, Owen, how Smuggling the Tin appears within the story. The women, Sarah, Ellen and Katrina that I mentioned, they tell these stories. I think it's the very first story. One of the first stories we hear is about an old fella up on the side of a mountain, a woman who comes to visit him and he kind of falls in love with her against all of his instincts, and a missing goat.
Yes.
I mean, the madness of that story is brilliant. So tell us a little bit about the story and where the song fits in.
It's the story itself is called The Old Man at the Mountain. Where again, where a man cranky and lonesome on a stark kind of mountain gets visited by a woman called Gidge. And Gidge is an important name in the community because it's one of the versions that were named for Bridget. And Gidge is a symbol that appears time and time again.
And is that is that like a cant name, if you don't know? Because there are lots of little cant words within the script as well.
Oh yeah, infused within it, because even when we were creating the framework for the structures done the assembly, which means it wasn't just here's the script, it's like going, what words would she say? What would you say? How would you react? People were naturally speaking in cant. Like Ellen, for example, would never, rarely have ever say the word children. She always referred to children as Galias, because they're Galias. So what, rather than that, kind of sculpt the story in these different ways, we allowed it to enhance and grow. And that song, because when we're actually speaking and walking through the process of what song would fit, was something that was proposed by Rosie herself, which kind of seeing kind of this fits here. So rather than telling kind of Rosie, kind of going, we have an idea, is going, what do you think fits part of this?
What does the word innick mean?
Like, innick means thing.
A thing.
Or a thingamabob. But also you can say things like innick, innick. It's all because we've all these body gestures. So it's a situational pronoun. So it's effectively
it's like, what do you call it? When we can't quite find the word we're looking for, we say
And there's unusual linguistic rules around it as well. But I think it's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, because it sounded to me there like you were doing something like innick na hinnick. It sounded like the Tishil Ginnadhuk in Irish. So the Tishil Ginnadhuk exists in Cant as well. Everybody has to deal with that wonderful case. We were saying then that the song that you have for us,
Smuggling the Tin,
this is part of that story, kind of fits in with this. So maybe you'd give us a little bit of the song.
Young Cooney and Collie and old Martin Quinn, while they made up together to smuggle the tin with me, right on and earning. Right on and in and right on and eh. They walked all the day by cedar hills, they grew raw while they had in the comfort of lying in the straw with me, right on and in and right on and in and right on and eh. I'll yoke her, says Cooley, flying wise to her tricks, but the more that he yoked her, the more the mare kicked with me, right on and in and right on and in and right on and eh. The old lady's high boys and me old mare she's tin, and my heart lies a trembling for fear she'll give in with me, right on and in and right on and in and right on and eh. Well, I once had a Bible all covered in dots, and it's many the fiver she won in the trots with me, right on and in and right on and in and right on and eh. Up came the old sergeant with a laugh and a grin, said, I'll have ye inside, boys, for smuggling the tin with me, right on and earning. Right on and earning, right on and eh.
Yes. Absolutely amazing. Smuggling the Tin, the title of that song. And what I don't know if the audience here in the town hall could see it, but what was amazing about that was often when people are in a tense situation like this, you know, the throat gets all tight and you see the veins standing out. You were as calm as a butterfly sitting, singing that, Rosie. And then that's why the voice comes out with such clarity. Paul Fahey is still with us here. It struck me that what Owen and Rosie are both talking about there, we were talking about the ash tree earlier on. This is about another type of conservation, if you like, a conservation of traditions, this show.
Absolutely. And we were so thrilled when Moonfish and Mairead, Nick Cronin, came to us with the proposal for the show. And they got one of our Elevate bursaries, which is developing new work. And it was absolutely down our street. We absolutely love what they've been doing. And they've been just bringing joy into the theatre. We've been down around there for the last week or so as they've been technical rehearsals happened and all that kind of thing. But it's so important that it's highlighting it and it's telling that story. So thank you so much. And that was beautifully sung, Rosie.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, and I'm trying to look at some of the other words I jotted down from the Golias. I thought it was just girls, but Golias is young children, boys, yeah. Boys and girls. And then the Bures and the Fines.
Fien is man Fien. And Bure is the woman.
Fien. Yeah, I'd heard Bure before. I hadn't heard Fien.
Yeah, you often find it far more infused in places with large marketplaces. Places like Cork, where there's been far more interaction between travellers and the wider population. People have carried a lot of our language.
And I noticed that the shows are all sold out. You put on extra shows. They're 1 p.m. and 6 p.m. daily. You put on extra shows. They're all sold out as well. Is there further life in this?
We'd hope. We'd be very open to it. And I think because especially their traveller stories, and like travellers, our story should travel.
Yeah.
And if I could just add, it's also very beautiful to look at. There's gorgeous shadow puppetry. And
we should have mentioned the shadow puppets, which are part of the storytelling.
The design
process.
is really gorgeous.
And I know that Rosie is recorded for this manifestation. We want her singing live
at
some point along the way.
Please go, Jet.
Yeah, you'll have to know it because... Yeah, the live singing that you just gave us was absolutely amazing. That's it. From Owen the Vardy and Rosie McCarthy, thanks very much. McCarthy Adair, beg your pardon, Rosie, and indeed Artistic Director of the Festival, Paul Fahey. Why the Moon Travels is at the Bank of Ireland Theatre in the University of Galway today, tomorrow and Saturday, 1 p.m. and 6 p.m. All the shows are sold out, unfortunately. But you never know, there might be cancellations. You could check it out, the website giaf.ie for full details there. And back with the final part of Arena at the Galway International Arts Festival after this break. And welcome back to the Town Hall Theatre in Galway for this Arena special from the Galway International Arts Festival. Oisín Leach released his debut solo album last year to great critical acclaim. The album is called Cold Sea. We heard Oisín perform his song One Hill Further at the very beginning of the programme this evening. Now, you all heard the soulful nature of that song. Very typical, I think, of the album in general and of Oisín, if I may say. It was recorded in Donegal Schoolhouse overlooking the Atlantic Ocean. The people like Tony Garnier are on the album, Donal Lunny. Oisín is also a playwright. And put some of his inspiration down to Seamus Heaney. Bruce Chatwin's song lines, which we heard about with the item we were just talking about with Rosie and Owen, and the ocean's healing power, that is also in there. And you're such a calm-looking fella as you sit there across from me, Oisín. And then I look down and I hear these songs, these wonderful, calm, gentle songs. And then I hear that you started with a punk band called The Vermin.
Yes.
The Vermin, that side of your character. Can I see some of that, please?
Get a foot up on the monitor, you know. Rocket. Yeah, no, the Clash and the UK Subs and the Stiff Little Fingers. I had a cassette of the Stiff Little Fingers walking to school every morning for years in primary school.
But did you walk or did you like jump, hop, run to Stiff Little Fingers as you were going along?
We were the only four punks in Navan when I was growing up, you know. And I had green hair and we all had skateboards. But then at the age of 16, a school friend, Alan Quinn, he's tuned in from Barcelona this evening, he brought us in a Rory Gallagher album. And then he started bringing us in David Bowie, Dylan, and then that opened up just a whole
right, yeah, because Rory Gallagher, we're still in a high energy place, I think, with that. Bowie, you're across all sorts of things.
Yeah.
Dylan, then, I think we're coming closer to where you are now. And I'm thinking also of yourself and Mark McCausland and the Lost Brothers. That had a gentler feel to it as well, a more folk and acoustic feel. Has that overtaken your life now? You've calmed down, you're looking at the ocean on a daily basis. From Navan, I don't know that you can see the ocean.
Yeah, no, it's funny. It's like it's interesting what Rosie said about sad music. You know, all my favorite music are sad songs. You know, maybe like Townes Van Zandt or a Planxty song or the voice of Andy Irvine. Like, there's a clear line for me between Andy Irvine singing and Skip James, the blues, the melancholic, the beautiful, soulful yearning. Mm. And I get that yearning when I'm by the ocean, which is what inspired this record. My mother's family are from Inishowen, so I was up there a lot with my wife and kids and just found myself writing a book of songs.
Yeah, and in fact, you brought in, I'll just bend around here to get it from the floor, you brought in a vinyl version of the album, Cold Sea, and I'm showing it here to the audience in the Town Hall Theatre. Beautiful painting on both the front and the back. And yeah,
that's by classic Sinead Smith, Inishowen painter.
Yeah, it's a classic Donegal feel off the kind of the madness of that. And I'm looking at the lyrics of One Hill Further, just looking at the opening. Sadness runs like a fever. So what is it about sadness that is... And it's not that everything you do is in the minor key, you know. There's brightness in what you're singing as well, even when there's sadness there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't dance around the kitchen to Leonard Cohen, but I do I do really connect with sad music. I mean, I love The Clash, and I love some of Joe Strummer's weirder Sandinista songs. And then that song, One Hill Further, we talked about Bruce Chatwin. I wrote that song very quickly one day. It came out, fell onto the page. It rarely happens. But it's in that book, Songlines, the Aboriginals, hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago in Australia, they believed that their landscape, their world, was sung into existence. Mm. And I loved that idea. I'm rereading the book to try and get my head around it. And that song, One Hill Further, is my version of driving south from County Meath north, and an imaginary line, and the song falls along that line and then reaches the ocean. And then, you know, when I sing that song in concert, I see a very clear film in my head. You know, the songs are kind of filmic.
Strike me that, because, I mean, I'm looking again a little bit further down into the lyrics. I knew a story about the clemency, a brother lost brother, a tragedy. And there's four lines of a lyric that tell a huge story across four lines. That storytelling aspect, as you say, almost filmic. You often hear that a song can make a great film, or a short story can make a great film, or a short story can make a great song. All those forms, all those different ways of telling story are all interrelated.
Absolutely, yeah. And like, sometimes I could spend months on a song and it would never make the album. But that song, One Hill Further, came very quickly. And I even when people ask me, I don't know quite where it's from. But it feels good to sing. These songs, Sean, I kind of had the luxury of time when I was writing this album, because I run a folk club in Navan and I wrote these songs for the folk club. So I had no idea what was going to even become of these songs. And then it became my debut solo record.
But the presence of the sea, now I know you've mentioned that you went up, your mother's from Inishowen, and that you went up there a lot as a kid, because I'm from Monaghan, landlocked like Navan, the sea wasn't really part of the tradition. Does something happen to you, I suppose, creatively, spiritually, particularly now as an adult? You might not have felt it as a child necessarily, just other than this is great fun being up here. Does something happen to you creatively when you're at the sea, literally, as opposed to inland?
Absolutely. Like, coming from Navan to Bunkrana is like arriving in Las Vegas. You know, it's like just opens up. It's exciting. When I see the sea, I kind of feel strangely at home. It's very creative. And it's back to that yearning. There's a great Greta Garbo quote about the ocean. You know, it's hilarious. She said a lot of hilarious things. But one beautiful quote she said was that like the ocean, it's I'm always yearning, you know. And when I look at, on this album, I used the kind of sparkle of the sea, the Atlantic Ocean, as a canvas. And then I projected these stories and themes on that. That was my canvas. And then I tried to paint these little songs, you know.
Which maybe wasn't that big. I thought he made a great sacrifice to us travelling west from Navan then to come down, because you came down especially to be part of this programme this evening. Your gig is actually on the final night of the festival, Sunday week. So you came down just to be part of the programme. We're deeply grateful for that. Yeah. Is there a different feeling on the West Coast than there is up on the Northwest Coast?
Yeah, no, it is fascinating. I mean, walking around Galway today, I mean, the city's just buzzing. It's vibrant. There's definitely an energy here. You know, it's stunning, really beautiful. I love coming here, and I can't wait to do this gig. Pearly are going to be with me, and Graham and Cormac, Irish band.
On that final night.
So we have a big band. Cannot wait. But there is a different energy in Donegal. You know, it's all the beautiful colours of the ocean.
Did that feed into the song Empire that you're going to perform for us now? Tell us a little bit about the story that you're telling here in song.
So Empire was one of the last songs I wrote for Cold Sea, and I wrote it, I had this chord pattern, and I kept just repeating this chord pattern, and these words came. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Well, let's hear it. So right. Empire from Oisín Leach.
In an empty room with an endless view, with nothing to see but these empire blues, to find this place you've come so far. Sun stoned and sky scarred, but now you'll watch it fall down again, our empire of rain. Where the sun shines, you'll find cold sorrow. And if you go back, I cannot follow. I'd only watch it fall down again, our empire of rain. Empire of rain, bruised, battered, and stained. Sing for a change, I choose to sing for the rain. I could turn this around just to carry the strain. Instead, I'll watch it fall down again, our empire of rain.
Empire, the title of that song from Oisín Leach, and you heard Graham Heaney on double bass, Cormac Curran on keys. Oisín and the lads, I think, will be there as well at the Rushing Dove on Sunday, the 27th of July, final day of the Galway International Arts Festival. So, to Tactile Tunes, collaborative and inclusive art installation developed by artist Jane Cassidy and the community arts group Arts Alive Galway. Project was designed to foster accessible music making experiences for individuals of all abilities, particular focus on adults with intellectual disabilities. The installation has art, technology coming together in a really engaging way, offering instruments that respond to touch, to movement, and they create sound as a result. Delighted to be joined for the final part of our programme this evening from Galway by curator Jane Cassidy and one of the artists, Natasha Lydon. Thanks to both of them for coming into us. Jane, you might just explain to us what exactly Tactile Tunes is. It's a whole series of separate pieces that involve the person who's looking at it or interacting with it making music for themselves.
Yes, it's like an immersive installation. So it's like you walk into the Aurora Borealis, and then within it, there's seven instruments, and they've all been designed by the 13 artists of Arts Alive. They're totally tactile, multi-sensory. Like, one is a stone piano made from stones collected from Claddagh Beach on the Oisín tip, you know.
You so know, the sea is all over this as well.
The sea is all over it. And every instrument is tuned so that they all play in harmony together. So that everyone that comes in, they're not going to hit any bum notes. So everybody feels like a musician.
They're Mozart.
You know, everybody's Mozart. And it's super, like, relaxing and fun. Like, we've one instrument that you can touch, that you feel the sound vibrations through your hand, so that, like, we've been working with people with hearing impairments, so then this way is a new way to...
Everybody can experience the
absolutely,
music
absolutely, yeah.
In whatever way it works for them. And as I said, one of the artists is with us as well. Delighted to have Natasha Lydon sitting in front of me here in the Town Hall. Cosmic CDJ is what your piece is called, Natasha. And the DJ is important within that. You do a bit of DJing, I believe.
Yeah, it is the Cosmic CDJ that I come up with, me and another artist named David McInnena. So we both came up with that. And then, as you know, I am a DJ that I do DJing every Monday night in the Ocean Dove. That's why there's a nightclub called Bounce.
Because of you and your DJing. Maybe you should have a new handle for yourself called Natasha Bounce Lighting. I think you should go with that, Natasha. Jane mentioned the Aurora Borealis or the Northern Lights. How have they inspired or fed into what you're doing in your piece?
Well, when I found out that we were going to have the Aurora Borealis here in Galway...
It's quite recent it was seen, wasn't it, in the last 12 months or so?
Because my sister, who lives out in Kinfara, she's seen loads of them. So that's why I based the projections I did. That's why I project them on the projector in the...
Yeah, they go up onto a screen or onto the wall or something. I have to ask you, because I'm looking, I think Jane is pointing to it as well. It's only now I'm noticing your T-shirt, which unfortunately the audience at home cannot see. But explain the colours of that, which I think probably feed into your experience of the Northern Lights, do they?
Yeah, actually, my T-shirt does go involved with the Aurora Borealis. Like, I've pink, blue, green.
And kind of purple. There are purples in there. So, yeah. You know, because wherever you're standing, the Northern Lights can look different. And if you move 20 metres down the road, you can see different colours. So these colours on your T-shirts were the ones that you saw?
Yeah, those are the colours I used for the projections.
Because you have, I think is it seven buttons in total that you have, and the person who's interacting chooses which button they press?
Yeah, there is seven buttons, and whenever one person presses one of those buttons, the projections change automatically.
And making that piece and having your piece, like this is a piece by Natasha Lydon, that being seen, what's the feeling in that for you?
Well, when I was trying them out on Procreate.
Which is an app on the iPad. Yeah,
it's an app on the iPad. I just like, when I was doing them, I found myself... immersive into the Aurora Borealis, and that gave me the inspiration of doing them, because the Aurora Borealis is dancing ribbons of light in the night sky.
Ah, and that is what you created in the installation itself, Jane. I can hear from Natasha how empowering that experience has been from her, and I suppose that is a major part of what you're trying to do with Tactile Tunes and indeed with Arts Alive.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's incredible to be part of the festival where representation for us is front and centre, so that artists with intellectual disabilities can have their work seen by a huge audience. We've already had 1,000 people in 3 days.
Wow.
Like, it's crazy.
Have you been up there for any of that, Natasha? Have you seen people coming in and interacting?
I've seen, when we first opened it, there was like 1,000, 2,000 people there.
That's not bad. That's not bad. A few more than get into the Roisin Dove when you're DJing on a Monday night.
Well, and tonight they're DJing after Natasha Bedingfield and Sophie Alice Bexter at the Rowing Club for the Festival Club.
Excuse me very much. Well, enjoy that. And thank you so much to both Jane Cassidy there and in particular Natasha Leiden for telling us about her work. Tactile Tunes, as you heard, is at the Aula Maxima in the University of Galway, 1 to 6pm during the week, 11 to 6pm at the weekend, Saturdays and Sundays, right through until the end of the festival, which is, of course, Sunday week. Lots happening between now and then. Sunday week, July the 27th. And that is it. GIAF.ie, GIAF.ie. You'll find out all of the details there. But that's it for our first special at Arena celebrating the Galway International Arts Festival 2025. Our thanks to Sinead O'Doherty MacDonald, all the team at the Galway International Arts Festival for their help in putting together the show. Also to Fergal McGrath and all here in the Town Hall Theatre for their hospitality, indeed, for us to, this evening. Research for tonight's programme was by Leah Murphy and Paula Shields. The BCO was Ollie Hamilton. On sound were Paddy Carney and Mark Dwyer. And the programme was produced by Reg Luby. We'll be broadcasting from the Galway, the RTE Galway studio, tomorrow evening. Bernard Butler, yes, Bernard Butler of Suede, of Altamont and Butler, and who made an amazing album with Jesse Buckley a while back. He will be with us playing live on the programme. Druids, Gary Hines, Marty Ray and Marie Mullen will be there to talk about their festival Double Bill. And we'll be reviewing some of the shows at this year's festival with Judy Murphy and Mary McGill. That's all tomorrow night. So till then, from me, Sean Rocks, good night from Galway.